It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, federal prosecutors said last week that lewd photos of teenage girls were found in wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein's safe. Since then, the case has quickly unfolded, even including the resignation of a Trump cabinet member. We'll look at the details coming up. First, for years in the U.S., a lot of people experienced ramen just as an instant meal. You boil some water, soak a dried brick of wavy noodles, add the spice packet, you got a cheap meal. But more recently, people have been sitting down to more creative, gourmet versions of the Japanese cuisine. And while it can be fun to slurp your way to a belly full of braised pork, pickled veggies, and chewy long noodles, what about making it all at home? For this week's Food Friday, we're going to talk with Chicago-based chef and author Hugh Amano about how to get our ramen on. Hugh has a new book out on the subject, co-authored. It's called Let's Make Ramen, a Comic Book Cookbook. Hugh joins us now from Chicago. Hugh, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon.
Well, we mentioned people might be familiar with that, you know, six for a buck ramen noodle from the store. Talk about the real deal versus what we might have experienced if that's all we've ever had.
Well, that's okay, because that really exposed so many of us to ramen. Of course, that's the easy way to do it. It's loaded with sodium and fat, and the way that we are trying to promote it in the book is just the homemade version, the way they do it in the ramen shops in Japan and here in the States. And it's just a super clean version, but still with all the great flavor, all the great components.
A lot of people are getting into ramen these days, it seems like. You, as I understand it, Hugh, you really like ramen, and you have for a long time. Could you talk about how you got to be a ramen expert and connoisseur?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just from growing up eating ramen. My father is Japanese, so I'm fortunate enough to have spent quite a bit of time in Japan as a kid. But of course, I was having ramen here in the States. Over there, I'd eat it occasionally in shops, but a lot of times at home there as well. As I grew up and my palate evolved and I became a chef and all of that kind of stuff, ramen kind of grew with me, and it really took off in that time period as well. There are a lot of chefs in Japan who started kind of dressing it up. You know, it really originated as a working class food. And something quick and easy to eat in train stations when you're on your way home. But in the past 20 or 30 years, there's been a lot of growth in creativity and just really refining. And that there's a Japanese word called shokunin, and that means just really refining what you do, doing one thing and doing it really well. So a lot of great new toppings and broths and even noodles have come out of that.
I love that you start the book with recommendations on how to not cook ramen, but how to eat ramen. And it sounds like if I'm not slurping, I'm doing something wrong.
Absolutely. So slurping, you know, we're taught here in the States, don't make noise when you eat and be very proper. Slurping, it's one of those things I have to turn my brain off if depending on what I'm eating. The other day I was at a restaurant here in Chicago eating this great spaghetti dish that I love, and I just found myself just slurping it in, and everybody's kind of looking at me, you know. But the idea with slurping is that you're cooling off the noodles and the broth. The ramen is meant to be eaten really quick. The noodles are strong, but of course they're still in a really hot broth, so they're going to continue cooking. As you slurp, obviously you're bringing in a lot of air into your mouth as you're eating. It kind of cools things off, and it also really activates the olfactories and gets things going. And it's just, you know, it's part of just eating with gusto, like really being engaged in what you're doing and what's in front of you. And it's a fun way to eat too. Just, I mean, it can get kind of messy, obviously, so be careful what you wear while you're eating ramen.
Talking to Chef Hugh Amano, his new cookbook is Let's Make Ramen, a Comic Book Cookbook. Why a comic book version? This is your second time tackling a style of food in comic form.
Yeah, so our first book, the first book that I worked on was with a guy here in town who owns a restaurant called Fat Rice. I helped he and his partner open the restaurant. We moved on to working on the cookbook for that together. And as we were developing it, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's beautiful photographs in there, and we've spent a lot of time on the recipes and writing. But one of the really strong aspects of that was the illustrations that we included. And we included them because we have a great artist in our crew. Her name is Sarah Beacon, who I ultimately co-authored Let's Make Ramen with. She just did some great artwork for us, and just we fell in love with the style. And then we decided that that would be a great way to show some of the more intricate type techniques and methods in the that first book called Adventures of Fat Rice, and, you know, like making dumplings and that sort of thing. It's easier to show someone that than to tell them. Like, writing how to fold a dumpling is, like, impossible. So from that, that was where I met Sarah. And then, you know, the publisher contacted us and wanted to do a book on ramen and thought that this would be a great way to present it. And the way it reads, you know, like, we could have a book with 99 recipes of ramen, and it would be a picture of the same bowl. You can make that picture beautiful if it's a photograph. However, Sarah's just so creative and expresses all of our ideas so well throughout the book. And it's just a much more engaging medium, I think.
Let's get into what we're going to do if we want to try to make ramen at home. First, get our toolkit going. What kind of ingredients and flavors do we want to have handy as we start to cook?
Yeah, so that's the thing. And one thing to understand about this book is that it's all about making the components of ramen and having them on hand so you're good to go. The question that I get with this book is, what's the go-to recipe in here? What's the one thing that I should try? And it's like, you kind of got to check
all
out
of
a
it,
few
man.
Things. Yeah, all of it. That's always my answer. But in the back, there are some kind of single-shot recipes that you could do start to finish. But I would suggest starting with the broths, you know, making good, strong broth. So I think it's important to get to make it as we have it in the book. Good, clean chicken bones or chicken thighs work great for the broth. Another ingredient, though, that might be kind of tricky or new for some people is an ingredient called kombu. That's a really thick type of seaweed or kelp that brings a lot of great umami flavor to the finished bowl and the broth. Another thing is called katsuobushi, and that's the dried skipjack tuna that gets shaved, and it's very thin. It basically just dissolves in the soup, as well as niboshi, which are tiny little Japanese sardines. And, you know, I sound like I'm just making the fish broth to end all fish broths, but it's actually – it doesn't taste fishy. It's just a really nice, round, meaty umami flavor. Oceanic is what we like to call it, rather than fishy.
Let's talk noodles now that we got that broth going. You give instructions on how to make our own noodles. Let's say we're not quite that adventurous yet. We're at the store, maybe in an Asian market. What are we looking for when we look for good ramen noodles?
Yeah, so you'll find, you know, depending on where you're at, you'll see a ton of noodles available, especially, you know, I'm down in Chicago and we have great Asian markets here. And there's just aisles upon aisles of noodles that you can get. But what you want to look for is something implying that there's some kind of alkalinity in the noodles themselves. And so when I say that, I'm saying look for the word bicarbonate or even just carbonate or even mineral salts. Because that's the substance in the noodles that gives the noodles their strength. It kind of encourages some of that yellow color that we're used to in the ramen noodles, and that will help it hold up in broth. Never try to make ramen with just plain noodles or like spaghetti or something like that. They'll just disintegrate in that broth.
We're talking to chef and author Hugh Amano about ramen and his new comic cookbook, Let's Make Ramen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a ramen fan? Have you eaten it at restaurants here in the United States? Have you been to Japan and tried ramen? Is this part of your maybe family tradition? Are you curious? Do you have questions about how to make it at home? Have you tried to make it at home? Any failures you want to share? Any questions on how to fix that up? Or are you a pro with some advice to share with us? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with chef and author Hugh Amano about the new book, Let's Make Ramen, a comic cookbook. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of ramen noodles? Have you made your own? Do you have questions about how to cook this at home, how to make different broths, or what kind of toppings go in? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to a caller, Malvi in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, am I on air?
You're on the air. Yeah, hi.
Yeah, so like I was saying, I just recently, in the last couple of years, been making my own ramen, you know, with the noodles and ingredients and everything. And I find that the broth is the one thing that I'm always, it's either hit or miss. I was wondering, what are the best bones to use? Sometimes I use chicken. Sometimes, one time I even used rib bones. But what do you think are the best bones for a good bone broth?
All right, the best bones, Hugh. Question. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of depends on what you're ultimately going for. If you're doing like a really rich, if you're going for a really rich pork broth, use the trotters. Ribs are a great source of flavor in there. But if you're getting into like trotters, like pig's feet and whatnot, that'll bring a whole lot of gelatinous body to the soup. But beware, because that is a very big soup. It'll be really strong. If you're looking at chicken, we use just whole, you can use a chicken carcass, like if you break it down and just take the meat and save it for something else, and just use the entire remaining frame of the chicken, because there's a lot of good meat flavor on there, and there's a lot of collagen in the back and the legs as well. And then chicken feet are really good also. But it really depends on what you're ultimately going for. And the more, just think of it this way, the more cartilage in there, the more sort of joints, the more gelatin that will be extracted, that'll ultimately lead to a much rounder, richer mouth feel. Hold back on that if you're trying to go for a lighter broth.
Malvi, thanks a lot. Good luck with your future ramen experiments. We'll go now to Frank with us in Milwaukee. Frank, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Frank?
The texture of the noodles in Japan is just fantastic. I can taste every fiber is just different. I don't know why that is.
So why would the texture be better with the noodles in Japan than, I guess, here in the States, Hugh?
Well, really, the important part of that texture are the alkalines that I was talking about before. And that, so it's a substance called kansui, K-A-N-S-U-I. And that is, it can be found in liquid form or powder form and added to the noodles when you're making them. And what that does is it just really reinforces all of the gluten in the noodles, makes them really strong and springy and bouncy, and really chewy. And that's the difference. And so that's a great point. That's a very key part to a great bowl of ramen.
Frank, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Pelican Lake. Hello, Jeff.
Oh, hi. I'm just reminiscing. I was born in 48, so we go back to when it was really hard to get any kind of Japanese food, like in the Milwaukee area. So we'd go to Chicago, and we'd get the Chinese noodles that came in a long box. And I think it was maybe like a 5-pound box of noodles. And then for the dashi, my mother would get a bag. It was sort of like a cloth bag, and everything was in the bag, and all you did is boil it with like 4 cups of water. And that inside was all the dried fish, the seaweed, and the dried shrimp, whatever else. And my mother and sister used to eat what was left in the bag after using it to make the broth.
Interesting, Jeff. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, so have you ever seen that, having the stuff in a cloth bag, Hugh?
No, that sounds pretty interesting, though, and I love the using it afterwards, too, but that's an absolutely great idea.
Jeff, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to Hugh Amano about cooking ramen at home. His new cookbook is Let's Make Ramen, a Comic Cookbook. Well, Hugh, we've talked a lot about broth, a little bit about noodles. Let's talk about all the other stuff. There's so much variety of different things you can put in ramen. You've got a lot of different examples in the book. Just give us a taste of the range of things that might end up in our bowl.
So many things, and that's the great thing about ramen. You know, Japanese cuisine is so codified, and like, everything has to be just so, and really to great effect. But this is the one area where you can really freestyle, and there's just so much going on that you can put into a bowl. And, you know, we include ajitsuke tamago, which is a very important component, and that's just that great seasoned ramen egg. With menma, which is the fermented bamboo that's also highly seasoned. We include in the book things like pickled shiitake mushrooms for a great bolt of acid and all that richness, and crispy chicken skins that are, you know, if you cook them right, they're just really nice, crispy, and they shatter in the ramen. Really good flavor. We like to lighten it up as well with some greens. There's we include a lot of recipes for steaming, sautéing, using a wok, all of that kind of stuff. And then components like flavored oils are really nice, and we give recipes for a few different ones in here. My favorite would be the ryu. That's the Japanese chili oil, and you know, you're cooking things like scallion, ginger, garlic. You're cooking that in sesame oil and just getting it really extremely flavorful, and you just drizzle that right on.
And Hugh, you talk about in the book the best way to eat ramen is piping hot. You don't want to dilly-dally while you're eating it, but we're looking at 90-somethings around Wisconsin. I'm sure Chicago's not any cooler. It's humid. Is there an appropriate cold version of a ramen recipe?
Absolutely. And I should lobby for eating hot ramen on a hot day. We had our book release party. We had a guy named Mike Satinover doing great ramen there for us. And I ate that bowl in 6 minutes, slurped it down. It was hot, new wave, shoyu chicken broth style ramen. It was great. But yes, there are cold ramens. Tsukemen is the most notable one. And that's where you'll see ramen noodles on the side. Then you have a bowl of really extremely highly concentrated broth. That you take the noodles from the cold bowl and just dip them into the sauce and slurp them right up. Ooh. And so there's no hot broth involved. There will be a plate of toppings as well that you can pick out as you're going. And it's just a great, cool dish for a hot summer day.
We got an email from Allison in La Crosse. Allison says, I lived in Hokkaido for 2 years where they add a butter and corn to the ramen. The Sapporo Airport had a really great ramen restaurant where you can get any kind of ramen, but the Hokkaido kind is the best. Is there a lot of a regional variation in Japan, Hugh, when it comes to ramen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you go to the southern tip, to the northern tip of Japan, you're going to encounter hundreds, if not thousands, of styles of ramen. And as it grows, it's just getting more and more diverse. And that's really the fun thing. And here in the States, you can get it too. You go down, there's a great place down in Austin. They do use smoked brisket on their ramen, and it just makes sense. You're in Austin, capital of smoked brisket, and that's what they use in ramen. It's really cool.
Did I read somewhere, as part of your research for the book, you went to Japan and did a crash ramen tour?
Yeah, something like that. So, again, I've been eating it my whole life.
Sure.
But this, when I was really focused and like really revved up, I was eating, you know, like 4 to 6 bowls a day. Which I don't necessarily recommend to do, but it's a great way to learn more about ramen and get as many styles in your belly as possible.
In Japan, is it like, you know, we are with brats in Wisconsin, where everybody has the right way to grill a brat and it's different from one person to the next? Are there arguments over what makes great ramen?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, oftentimes what makes great ramen is if you made it, you know, and it's totally, it just depends on the day. And it's just like barbecue here in the States, just like you're saying, brats in Wisconsin. Everybody has the right way to do it, you know, and no one can do it as good as you can.
Let's talk about what we drink with ramen. You have some very strong recommendations of things to drink and some things not that you say, you know what, if you want these, save them for after the ramen is done.
Yeah, typically, you know, in a ramen ya in Japan, ramen ya is the name for a ramen shop in Japan, you would be, you know, you'd be moving through. So oftentimes you're really just drinking cold water to kind of cleanse your palate as you go and cool you down a little bit. But you can also get beer. Japanese beer is absolutely great for that. I love Asahi. Kirin is great. Sapporo is great. And even a cold sake would be nice as well. I would avoid big things. You're not drinking big California red wines with ramen, and definitely like bigger IPAs, IPA beers would be kind of, they would compete with the ramen a little bit. So you kind of want a subtle subtle cool drink to have with it.
In our last couple minutes, Hugh, let's talk to a rookie like me who's never made a ramen dish at home before, you know, apart from, again, that 20-cent packet. How should we get started in a way that, you know, there's a good chance we're not going to completely fail?
Get started. Let's see. I would say just focus on each thing as its own little component. You know, start with one of those stocks. Make the basic chicken stock. Then make one of the tares, which is one of the seasoning agents. Super simple. We broke down the recipe, so they're just extremely simple. And once you're there, those two things, if you make a chicken broth and one of those tares, which could be as simple as just a little bit of vinegar and salt, combine them as we suggest in the book. Just taste that. And that little bit of success will fuel you to want to do more from the book. Buy some noodles. You don't have to make them. And just have a very simple, plain bowl of ramen like that. And you'll see the beauty of it. And it hopefully will inspire you to continue making and experimenting, not just in our book, but just, you know, the whole world of ramen. You can invent stuff, too.
Are you still, after all the ramen you've worked with in the book and eaten in your life and in researching the book, are you still finding new ways to prepare it?
I am, and it's great because the ramen community is so vast, so there's always opportunity to meet new people, know and learn what they're doing. And, you know, as a chef anyway, I'm exploring flavors all the time, so it's really fun to do that.
Hugh, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That's Chicago-based chef Hugh Amano. His new cookbook is Let's Make Ramen, a comic cookbook, along with illustrator Sarah Bican. It is recipes, but in comic form, so you get the visual on how to do all the different tasks. Some advice in there on making, eating, and enjoying ramen. If you are part of the ramen community, let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org or head on over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wealthy financier and registered sex offender Jeffrey Epstein is waiting trial on sex trafficking charges in jail. Epstein requested home confinement at his Manhattan mansion, but yesterday a federal judge denied him bail out of concern for public safety. After his arrest earlier this month, prosecutors said lewd photographs of teenage girls were found in a safe at his home. He's pleaded not guilty. He faces 45 years in prison if convicted. Epstein's many friends and acquaintances over the years have included President Trump, former President Clinton, Woody Allen, celebrities, scientists, and other famous people. So far, the case has resulted in the resignation of Trump's Labor Secretary Alex Acosta. As a U.S. attorney, Acosta prosecuted a case against Epstein that ended in a heavily criticized plea deal. Casey Frank is the senior editor for Investigations and Enterprise at the Miami Herald. Casey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Now, for people who haven't been following this huge story, give us a quick nutshell of who Jeffrey Epstein is.
Jeffrey Epstein is a very rich man. He lives part-time in Palm Beach, in the city of Palm Beach, but he also has homes all over the place. He has a $77 million home in Manhattan. He has a home in Paris. He has a ranch in New Mexico, and he has his own private island in the Virgin Islands. He's also very socially prominent. He's a charitable person who's given millions and millions of dollars to science foundations, to colleges, universities, including Harvard, which has received millions from him. He is also friends of many people in high political places. That would include the current president, President Trump, and the former president, Bill Clinton.
Now, we had this case back in 2008, prosecuted by Alex Acosta, now the Secretary of Labor, ended up with a fairly minor charges, with a minor sentence. Talk about your reporter now, Julie K. Brown, and what led her to dig deeper into this story and its outcome.
Okay. What led her to this story is that Julie Brown had done a great deal of reporting on the Florida prison system, which is a terrible prison system. And she zeroed in particular on Lowell Correctional, which is the largest women's prison in the country. While talking to inmates there and their loved ones, she found that many of these women had found themselves in bad circumstances and, in fact, had been sexually trafficked by somebody. That got her into the interested in the subject of human trafficking and in particular sexual trafficking. That led her to Jeffrey Epstein, and Jeffrey Epstein led her to Alexander Acosta, the former U.S. Attorney for Southern Florida who handled the Jeffrey Epstein case. At just about that same time, Mr. Acosta was going through confirmation hearings to become the Secretary of Labor for Mr. Trump. She watched those hearings and noticed that the Epstein matter was glazed over very lightly, and so she wanted to dig into it much more deeply, and that's what she did. She spent a year doing it, and she particularly looked at the secrecy that surrounded the non-prosecution agreement that essentially allowed Mr. Epstein to walk free, at least from federal charges. He, as part of this broader deal, he was able to plead to basically a simple prostitution charge, as if he had hired somebody while walking down the street. In fact, he'd been accused by dozens of underage girls of luring them to his house and coercing them into having sex. And honestly, there's been a lot of reporting on the Jeffrey Epstein case over the years. The two things that Julie K. Brown, our reporter on this topic, did that nobody else did was, number one, and this is critical, she tracked down some of the victims. That was very difficult because victims of sexual abuse, and particularly underage victims of sexual abuse, are not named in court documents, and so she had to go digging. That's number two. Number two is that she looked very hard at the communications between the battery of attorneys for Mr. Epstein and the line attorneys handling the case with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and found that, number one, there was a secret meeting between Mr. Acosta and Mr. Epstein's lead attorney at a local Marriott, at which they kind of solved this case, so to speak, and solved it in a way that was very favorable to Mr. Epstein. Number two, that even after that, there were demands, really demands, by the attorneys for Mr. Epstein, that the victims not be told what was being done at the case, and that is antithetical to the whole idea of criminal justice. A victim should be kept apprised of what's going on, and they should be able to go to court and if they want, object to how a case like this is being handled, or in this case, disposed of.
Talking to Casey Frank from the Miami Herald about the developing case involving Jeffrey Epstein. Casey, before we turn to the latest news, reading Julie Brown's story, it's chilling as the numbers of victims grow and the systematic nature of his trafficking operation, I guess, grew. Can you give us a sense of the scope of what Julie uncovered?
Well, the scope is that when the U.S. attorney essentially walked away from this case, there were 36 underage victims of what was essentially a sexual pyramid scheme, where Mr. Epstein would allegedly send out recruiters to malls, to parties, to places where young girls congregate, and invite people to young girls to come in and give him a massage in exchange for money. Then he would coerce them, sometimes allegedly force them to have sex with him. He would then offer them money if they would bring other people or other young girls to do the same thing. Hence the pyramid scheme. What Julie found is she was able to identify, not in print or not for publication, but she was able to identify by following various hints and breadcrumbs and whatnot, and talking to lawyers and getting access to previously secret documents. she was able to identify 80 victims of alleged victims, I should say, of Mr. Epstein. And so the scope seemingly was much larger than even previously reported before it was narrowed down to this very, very little, you know, small-time crime that he ultimately pled to. So she was able to shine a light on the fact that it was a much, much bigger circle of victims than had previously been known. I think she was able to also show that in reality, this was not a local Palm Beach crime. This was something that was done at other homes maintained by Mr. Epstein, as evidenced by the fact that he was arrested 2 weeks ago while returning from Paris and arriving in at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, and he is being charged by the Southern District in Manhattan, meaning the alleged crimes occurred not just here but there. We have since seen reports that the authorities in New Mexico are also looking into this. What Julie also found was that, allegedly some of the victims were being taken from home to home, transported in Mr. Epstein's private jets, one of which was known as the Lolita Express. So she was really able to sort of expand the understanding of the full scope of Mr. Epstein's alleged behavior.
So he is being held without bail now. One of the reasons this is getting so much attention is, as you mentioned, his prominent connections. Partying
Correct.
With Donald Trump, flying Bill Clinton around, connections with leaders in Saudi Arabia, Israel, the science world, the business world, top names in the law profession. People are wondering what kind of shoes are going to drop here. What are we watching for?
Well, we're wondering that, too. One thing we found this past weekend, and we wrote this up, was that the Epstein matter is roiling the waters of politics in Israel because a former prime minister, Ehud Barak, was a business partner of Mr. Epstein. I think that anybody who was socially connected with Mr. Epstein over the years, and that's a lot of people in important positions, is probably a little bit nervous about what might come out and what role they might have to play, if nothing else, as a witness, because there are many, many people who probably observed, if nothing else, that, gee, he's got a lot of very young young girls, trailing him wherever he goes. And the reporting suggests that he wasn't the most discreet individual. I cannot tell you whether, what the president did or didn't do, what Bill Clinton did or didn't do, other than the fact that they flew on his plane. I think we've all seen the video from earlier this week of President Trump partying with Mr. Epstein at Mar-a-Lago. I don't think that was the only occasion when that occurred. And of course, it's also been widely reported that President Trump had once praised Mr. Epstein as a heck of a guy and, somebody who also likes women like I do, and they also seem to be on the younger side. He made that observation a number of years ago. Now, he also says we had a falling out 15 years ago, which is pointedly right about the time that Mr. Epstein got in trouble with local authorities down here.
As we wrap up, what is next for Epstein himself and his trial, his case in New York and maybe elsewhere?
Well, he was denied bail yesterday by the judge, who called him a dangerous individual, at least to young women like these or these accusers. We believe he'll probably appeal that decision, but it seems like it's kind of an uphill climb. Today, the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office announced that it is opening an investigation of its handling of Mr. Epstein. And one thing we haven't discussed here is that while he was incarcerated for a little over a year in the Palm Beach County Stockade, after pleading to a very minor charge, he was allowed by the sheriff to leave the stockade for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, to go on work release. This was very non-standard work release. He basically went to an office that was adjoining his lawyer's office and got to receive guests, male and female, conduct business, to essentially do whatever he wanted to do, although I believe he also wore a ankle bracelet that tracked his comings and goings. That decision by the sheriff back then is causing quite a bit of consternation now, and the sheriff said, we're going to investigate that, although his announcement of this said, I'm going to investigate, or we're going to investigate the actions of my deputies on how they handled the work release. It did not seem to say whether the investigation also includes his decision to sign off on this very unusual agreement. So we shall see.
Casey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay.
Casey Frank is the senior editor for Investigations and Enterprise at the Miami Herald. We talked to him about the Jeffrey Epstein case. Epstein was denied bail yesterday and is awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. He faces up to 45 years in prison if convicted. Governor Evers' administration announced a $75 million grant program for transportation projects around Wisconsin yesterday. The money would be divided among cities, towns, and counties, and those local governments would apply for grants for projects for local roads or other transportation spending. The possibility that some of this money could now possibly fund Milwaukee's streetcar has some Republican senators calling for an override of Evers' budget veto that affected the program. Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
All right. It's a little convoluted how it was in the budget. It got vetoed and that took us here. Give us the timeline on that.
All right. So essentially what happened was when the governor issued his 78 partial vetoes of the state budget, this little pot of transportation money was one of those 78 partial vetoes. And what he did was he took $90 million that the Republican legislature had earmarked as one-time spending for transportation projects for local governments across Wisconsin, and not only reduced the amount from 90 to 75, but took away some earmarks that the legislature had put in there. They had specified of that $90 million how much was supposed to go to counties, how much was supposed to go to cities and towns, how much was supposed to go to villages, et cetera. The governor took away all those earmarks and said, I'm just going to give this $75 million to the Department of Transportation to do with as they will. They can sort of decide and prioritize. And what the Department of Transportation announced this week is they're using that $75 million for a grant program.
So how will that grant program work? How can local governments tap into that?
So it's going to be, as grant programs are, on an application basis. They are still going to divide it into those three different pots of money for the different sizes of communities. So, you know, counties will be competing against counties, villages will be competing against villages, et cetera, and specific amounts are going to those places. The way that the state and other stakeholders are going to decide who gets the money, according to the head of the State Department of Transportation, is there's going to be an analysis based on economic impact. They say that the projects need to be pitched in terms of how much of a benefit is this going to have for local economies and the statewide economy.
And a key here, these are transportation projects, which doesn't just mean road projects.
Exactly. This is another important change. So the money that was originally allocated by the legislature in the budget was to the local road improvement program, which is exclusively for local governments to use for roads. under this grant program, the Department of Transportation is opening it up to any sort of transportation program. So that could include public transit. It could include bike paths or pedestrian walkways or harbor improvements, any sort of thing that falls under the larger umbrella of transportation.
Let's give a listen to DOT Secretary Craig Thompson talking about that point.
But the point of the matter is not the project itself, it's what the end result is. It's the economic development that comes out of that. And so the governor, and I agreed, did not want to limit that strictly to that it would have to be a local road project.
That's the argument from the administration. What kind of pushback are we hearing now from members of the legislature?
So it's pretty strong pushback, actually. We've heard from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. They are not pleased with this grant program. And I think it's kind of boiling down to one particular potential use for this money, and that's the Milwaukee streetcar. This was something that came up during the unveiling of the grant program. A reporter asked, now, could potentially a program like the Milwaukee streetcar apply for this money and get it? The administration said, sure, that's something that would be eligible. And Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald responded to that pretty quickly and said, you know, this isn't the sort of thing that we should be sending state money to. The governor said that he was going to be sending money to fix roads in Wisconsin, and that particularly rural communities across the state should be concerned if more state money could go to something like the streetcar.
What would have to happen for Republicans to stop that from happening?
So this is something that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald did talk about when he issued his statement pushing back on the program. He said that he's considering a veto override of the governor, which would essentially take it back to that first step that the governor made to put this whole grant program in place, right? That $75 million, taking away the earmarks. Senator Fitzgerald said we're considering calling the Senate in, overriding that veto, which would essentially take that funding back to $90 million and give it just to that local road improvement program. We've also heard from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, and he says that he's strongly considering a veto override as well.
But that would take what? What would have to happen in the legislature?
So that would take a two-thirds vote of both of the chambers of the state legislature. And we know, of course, that Republicans have a majority in both the state Senate and the state Assembly, but they don't quite have that two-thirds majority that they would need for that veto override. So they would need some Democrats to come on board and vote for that.
This is all over the hypothetical application from Milwaukee to use the money for a streetcar, and then the state would have to approve that and say, yeah, you can get that bit of the grant money for it. Is there any indication that Milwaukee is planning to apply for that?
You know, actually, according to reporting from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett indicated that the city is not considering that application. So as you said, you know, it would take quite a few steps for that to take place. They would have to apply, the funding would have to be approved, and it sounds like the application might not even be happening.
Do we know when these applications are due?
We don't yet. So this is still pretty early in the process of the grant program being rolled out. We know that the State Department of Transportation is setting up this committee that's going to oversee the grants. It's going to be about half DOT employees and half stakeholders from local governments that are going to decide who gets this money.
We'll leave it there on that issue, Laurel. Briefly, we're going to talk about this more, but the state capitol, where you are usually working, not open for business most of the day today.
Nope. Was closed down today because of power outages in downtown Madison. So a little bit of a quieter Friday, at least. Things have been moved outside of the capitol building itself today.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's Laurel White, WPR state capitol reporter. We talked to her about a new grant program announced by the Evers administration that's facing some pushback and a potential attempt at a veto override from leaders in the state Senate and state assembly. What do Tang, Jell-O, Cool Whip, and Pop Rocks all have in common? Apart from only sort of being food, they were all invented by the same person. Sunday is National Junk Food Day, and to celebrate, Smithsonian Magazine looked back at the career of one of the nation's most prolific inventors of junk food. William Mitchell, born in rural Minnesota, started his food career at the crystallization tanks for the American Sugar Beet Company, and he went on to become a food scientist. His first big hit was a substitute for tapioca, which was in short supply because of World War II. In 1957, he came up with a powdered juice substance, Tang, which became famous as a beverage for astronauts, another big anniversary being celebrated. He tried to invent a self-carbonating soda, which led to the creation of Pop Rocks, the super fizzing candy, which, contrary to urban legend, apparently does not, in fact, kill people. And in 1967, he came up with two great tastes that taste great together, a gelatin that set quickly in cold water, which led to quick-setting Jell-O, and the fake whipped cream product Cool Whip. All told, Mitchell received about 70 patents in his career. So celebrate his inventing career and National Junk Food Sunday with a heaping helping of quick-set Jell-O with some Cool Whip on top, followed up with some Pop Rocks, and wash it down with Tang. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.